Doors for its support of Focus 580. Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, we will be talking in this hour about personal finance and money management. It's something that we feature as a topic on the program every month. It's always a Friday. And generally speaking, with our guest, the man who's here in the studio with me now, his name is David Sinnoh. He's professor at U of I, clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And once a month, he's here. We'll start out by talking a little bit about sometimes talks about the economy and what's happening with that. Sometimes he has a particular topic that he'd like to tell you about, and we'll do that to start. Then if you have questions on that or anything else that has to do with investing, financial planning, money management, I know Dave will do his best to give you an answer. So with that, we say welcome back. Good morning.
Well, good morning, David. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, while the weather has been hot and steamy, the stock market has been pretty bitter cold, especially the last several weeks. Just a month ago, investors were cheered by 10% gains in their stock portfolios, only to watch those gains quickly disappear and evaporate. In fact, as of yesterday's close, the major stock indexes were negative for the year. The S&P 500, that bellwether, was down 2% for the year. The Russell 2000, some of the smaller companies, well, they were down 3% for the year. And that fancy NASDAQ, those high-tech companies, well, they were down some 5% for the year. Even the value indexes are negative for the year, down some 1 to 2% for the year. So what we've seen is an across-the-board situation where we have stocks negative in almost all asset classes. Now, everyone's asking the question, what is accounting for this sudden and painful turnaround? Are we now looking at a stock market which could end negative? Again, four out of the past 5 years, it would then be negative. Well, a number of commentators point to the Iraqi war, both in terms of its monthly cost and the continuing awful news out of Iraq. But historically, Wall Street casts off events abroad and really focuses on the U.S. economy and its impact on publicly traded companies. So I think the answers probably lie in the state of our own economy. And the overwhelming consensus among economists is that the U.S. economy is indeed slowly recovering, but inflation is beginning to look a bit more troubling, and higher interest rates, well, they already have happened, despite the fact that the Federal Reserve has not changed the targeted Fed funds rate as yet. And of course, you'll recall that the Fed funds rate is the rate at which banks borrow or loan money to each other overnight, depending upon a bank's reserve requirements. So while people are fearing higher interest rates, the truth of the matter is that higher interest rates are already here. Now, in terms of economic recovery, the April job report indeed was encouraging. Some 288,000 new jobs were created, at least according to the DOL, the Department of Labor. The first quarter growth rate of the U.S. economy was tagged at approximately 4.5%. on an annualized basis. A similar growth rate, perhaps just a bit less in the 4% area, is predicted this quarter. The four-week average for new unemployment compensation claims is the lowest in the past 3 years. However, as we've seen with this recovery, or this so-called recovery, it seems to be extremely uneven, as many Americans still are not participating. For example, personal bankruptcies remain at record highs, as does mortgage defaults. Yet on balance, growth and job numbers indeed look promising. However, all of this news is really tempered by fears of inflation and higher interest rates. That seems to be the issue at the current time. That seems to be what Wall Street is really focused on. And remember, when Wall Street makes a move, it's usually signaling something that's going to happen maybe 4, 6, 8, even 12 months into the future. Now, on the inflation front, for the first time in 4 years, companies are now passing up the line pretty substantial price increases, both at the wholesale and the retail levels. For example, the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, has risen almost 2% in the first 4 months of this year. And the wholesale index, the producer price index, often referred to as the PPI, jumped just 0.7% in April. Everybody, of course, is pointing to oil as the culprit at almost $42 a barrel bid in the futures market, which, of course, we know translates into $2 at the gas pump. But let's not forget the dramatic increases of other commodities, especially in the agriculture and farming sector, which were very high, and they have sort of leveled off in the last couple of weeks. Now, historically, increasing inflation means higher interest rates, and Wall Street obviously is worried that higher interest rates will dampen the recovery and cutting into surging corporate profits. Every day we read in the financial journals, the Wall Street Journal, this company, that company, whether it's big or small, if it's a publicly traded company, we've had surging corporate profits, which in turn means higher dividends. But if we have higher inflation, higher interest rates, that means that corporations are going to borrow at more expensive rates. Perhaps people are going to cut back on their purchases, which means that corporate profits may be cut short. And when we have smaller corporate profits, that really means smaller dividends on stocks, and thus stocks become less attractive, especially if we enter into a period of rising interest rates where there are relatively other attractive investments. Now, if you go down to the bank today or you look at the Treasury market and you stay short, it's not terribly attractive. We're still looking at very, very low rates of return if you are a creditor. Maybe 1%, maybe 2%, perhaps 3% on your money. We'll take a little time a little bit later on in the program and look at some of the 1-year, the 5-year, the 10-year, and even the 20-year Treasury rates. But as interest rates ratchet up, relative attraction changes. And suddenly we start paying more attention to CD rates. We pay more attention to Treasury rates, and we invest more of our money in there, and stocks become less attractive, further dampening the demand for stocks. So bottom line is that higher interest rates dampen consumers' appetite for stocks. Already, we see in the interest rate front that 30-year mortgage rates are well over 6%. And continue to rise, and it will be interesting to see whether these rates will in fact impede the housing and new construction industry, which dropped a couple of percent between March and April. And of course, the housing industry, the construction industry, they've really been the standout. They've really been the stalwart performers for the past several years, and they have really buoyed the economy. So, David, there's just a whole host of topics we could talk about, we could visit about this morning. As I say, I want to spend a little time on interest rates, mortgage rates. But at this point in time, I'd be more than happy to tackle any questions posed by our listeners.
All right. Well, we have somebody who is ready to go. Other questions are welcome. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. Once a month is on this program, always a Friday. We talk about personal finance. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Whichever works for you, give us a call. We'll start with a listener in Savoy, line one.
Thank you. To what extent or what maturities are TIPS available in? And to what extent does the inflationary adjustment aspect of TIPS offset the risk of principal during a rising interest rate environment? That's question number one. And if I may ask question number two, other than index volatility, are there any attributes of ETFs that an investor should be aware of or be cautious against?
Well, with respect to the ETFs, you, of course, can trade intraday. That does make a difference. But interestingly enough, with a lot of ETFs, they are still thinly traded. And you have to be careful about the brokerage expenses. But in terms of initial liquidity and in terms of being able to move in and out during the day, that does have a big advantage. And mutual funds are extremely worried about the future of ETFs, especially some of the index mutual funds. Interestingly enough, though, at the really just the consumer level, they have not tremendously caught on. They've caught on somewhat among sophisticated investors and institutionalized investors, but for the average investor, they seem to still be married to the mutual funds. Whether that continues based upon all of the issues that are now facing funds, we'll stay tuned and see. But at the moment, are you an ETF trader?
Not right now.
Okay.
I'm considering it.
But you're looking at it.
Yes.
If you are a trader, are you a long-term investor or a trader?
Well, I'm more of a long-term investor, but I'm beginning to believe that strategies other than just buy and hold may be worthy of consideration.
Okay. Well, and there's no one strategy that works best, and if you are sophisticated, certainly ETFs make a good deal of sense. So I would not stand in your way of looking at ETFs as compared to index mutual funds, but be careful. People who do get involved in ETFs then immediately are sitting at their computers and have this proclivity to buy and to sell. And, hey, if you can figure that out, you know, don't tell anyone,
okay.
All right?
Thank
you. Because then you can get wealthy that way. All right, now with respect to indexed inflationary treasury securities, we're really looking at maturities that go from 07 all the way out to 32. I'm a little concerned about trading in the long-term maturities. I really think that you want to be looking at those maturities from the years 10, 11, and 12, 2010, 11, and 12. I think that's where you get the most bang for your buck. Now, keep in mind, again, that these are rather liquid, although I have known in the past from a lot of traders of these particular securities that you can get whipsawed a bit, and indeed the commission structure can also eat you up. So you have to be careful where you are buying these from and make certain that you have checked on the commission schedule ahead of time. So where do they make sense? They really make sense in a tax-deferred portfolio. So do you have them currently?
No.
Okay. Well, where you want to look at them is in a tax-deferred portfolio because the income that accretes on them each year is taxable even though you aren't paid in that income. So they make a lot of sense for people in IRA programs, in perhaps even 401k programs, 403b programs, if you have the right of self-direction. So you want to be looking in those maturities right now, 10, 11, and 12, perhaps. I think that's where the yield curve seems to be best. And also you want to look at them for tax-deferred investments.
May I ask a follow-on?
Sure.
I was considering them in the shorter maturities as a place to sideline cash.
Okay, well, the shortest maturities, you're really looking at 07. So in terms of a short maturity, we're really looking at least a, basically a 1 of 07. I think that's so, well, I guess that's not too far out. We're looking at 2.5 years, 2 years, 7 months. So be careful, though. Don't park all of your money there.
No.
Maybe 33% of your ready cash, I could live with that, but not more than that.
If one is anticipating a Fed funds move to 3.5%, perhaps 18 months out, will the inflation-adjusted aspect of these TIPS offset the risk to principal?
Well, it should. It should. But be careful to predict the future of interest rates. I read an article yesterday in the Wall Street Journal that 3.5% Fed funds number now seems to be a number that is being bandied about. And a lot of economists are thinking that that 3.5% number is going to be out in December of 06.
Okay.
That's when they're predicting that, but who knows?
Well, thank
who
you
knows?
So much.
Okay, my
right.
pleasure.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. We'll go on to another Savoy listener here, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I am changing jobs, and I'm going to be starting next week, and I'm very interested in participating. It's a large company, so I'm very interested in participating in their 401k program. However, I have some questions about how exactly I should place my money.
Yes.
They do have a broad spectrum of 9 different funds, bond funds, stock funds, and a variety of stock funds. But I'm also interested, so I'm interested in what you would think about placing into bond versus stock funds, and also if I should and to, if I should try and put money into, say, a Roth IRA on my own, in addition to the 401k, what are your thoughts about that? I'll hang up and I'll...
Why don't you stay on the air?
Oh, okay.
Just stay on the air. How old are you?
I'm 31.
Okay. So I need to know that, and I might have another question or two.
That's fine.
But the bottom line is, are you, for your 401k and changing jobs, do you have immediate eligibility? And that is that the day you show up, you can put your own money into these 401k programs.
Actually, the way that it works is, as I understand it, is they automatically enroll up to for a 3% contribution.
Yes. Yes.
And that will take effect as of the second pay period, which is a two-week pay period, so that within the first month.
Okay, and then you have the right to meet with benefits and increase the amount that you wish to defer.
Correct.
And then I presume that there is a salary match?
That does not take effect until 1 year after employment, initial employment.
Okay. And then can you tell me what the vesting schedule is? Do you have any idea of what the vesting schedule is on employer money?
Yes, it's actually 100%.
Can't beat that. So once you are with the company 1 year, they think you're a good bet, and then every dollar they put in that matches based upon your contribution, then that remains 100% vested in you.
Right.
And then does the company pay in stock, or does the company essentially pay and then allocate that money just like you've allocated your money?
You know, I'm not 100% certain about that.
Okay. There's usually two ways that this works.
Okay.
The first way is that some companies make the company match in the form of company stock.
Okay.
All right. The second way is they said, okay, you have 60% of your money in Fund A, 40% of your money in Fund B. That's what we're going to do, too, with our company match money.
Okay.
So that's a question that you do want to find out. If you have monies being paid to you in the form of stock of a company, then you want to find out how liquid that stock is and when you can actually negotiate and liquidate that stock and move over to other investments. Because
okay.
I typically recommend that no more than 10% of your entire 401k should be in company stock. And that doesn't matter whether it's my company or GE.
Okay.
All right? It just doesn't matter.
Okay.
You shouldn't have more than 10% in company stock. And then can you tell me when you put a dollar in what the match is?
You know, I don't know.
Okay, so you want to find that out as well
okay.
a year down the road. But in any event, you are only 31 years of age.
Right.
And remember that 401k money is supposed to be retirement money,
mm-hmm.
and you are supposed to begin accessing it at no sooner than 59 and a half without penalty, and in some cases age 55 if you decide to annuitize it over your life expectancy. So we're talking a long-term relationship here.
Mm-hmm.
We're really talking somewhere between 25 and 30 years.
Right.
And at least today, I can say without reservation that I haven't seen a 25 consecutive year period of time where a properly diversified portfolio of stocks did not outperform the best fixed income. I can't say that over any consecutive 10-year period, 15-year period, and indeed even a 20-year period, but I can say it over a 25-year period. No time in U.S. history have we had a period where if you invested in stocks for 25 consecutive years, you did it intelligently and you diversified your portfolio, unquestionably, unequivocally, you would have been better off than investing in fixed income.
Okay.
So bottom line is I believe that by far the lion's share of your money should be invested on a dollar cost averaging basis in equities, in stock mutual funds.
Okay.
And your job is to diversify among those funds.
Okay.
Fixed income doesn't make a lot of sense at this point in time. So at least 80%.
Okay.
At least, and frankly more, but at least 80%. If you are going to have some money in fixed income, say 10, 15, or 20%, then it should be very short-term fixed income, and you should think of it as a hedge against your stock position.
Okay.
And then if stocks fall out of bed, if they really fell out of bed, then you have some fire water on the sidelines that you could move back into the market. But it's difficult to time the market. So by far, the lion's share of your funds, because you're going to be dollar cost averaging, should go into diversified equities.
Okay.
Anything else you wanted to ask?
I did want to know if I should consider placing external monies into a Roth IRA. at this time?
By all means, yes, if you have that money, because remember that you're taking after-tax money. You can take up to $3,000 of after-tax money, place it into your own Roth IRA program, and there are circumstances where you can actually take that money out if you need it.
Okay.
For example, the first $10,000, regardless of whether it's principal or earnings, can be utilized toward a down payment on a home if you're a first-time home buyer. And even if you take money out of the portfolio, the worst that's going to happen is you're going to have a 10% penalty on the earnings.
Okay.
So it's a great way to invest tax-free. There's no 59.5 rule, no 55 rule, no 70.5 year rule. So a lot of those rules don't apply. As long as you hang on to that money till retirement, really 59.5, all of the funds that grow are tax free, and you don't even have to access it. So
Great. It's
a great retirement vehicle.
Great. Thank you very much. That was very informative.
Right. My pleasure.
Thanks for the call. We'll get right to next caller, somebody on a cell phone, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I'll try to make this as easy as possible. I switched jobs 6 months ago, and I started working for the U of I, and I'm participating in their program. I have money in it's really a profit sharing for me because I never contributed anything to the 401k. And what I wanted to do is have that 401k and put it in another one. And I'm kind of confused by the rules, and I know that leaving it in would be better sort of in the long run, but I have no information what it's invested in. I get very little information back from the place it's with Benefits Planning Corporation or something. I get a type statement once a year, and that's it. So for me, I just think taking it out and putting it somewhere else is better in the long run. So I'm just kind of wondering what they take 20% of it when you take it out. Do you then pay taxes on that amount after they've already taken the 20%? Is there like a double?
Oh, there's all kinds of problems. So let me explain the rules. All right.
Okay.
And first
okay.
of all, I think you are fortunate that regardless of what plan you are in, you have excellent plan administrators. Benefit Planning Consultants, which is a local firm in Champaign-Urbana, is an excellent plan administration firm. I've known those folks for many, many years, and I have a lot of confidence in them. That's number one. Now, number two, what you are thinking of doing is essentially taking money out of your profit-sharing plan. You're now at the University of Illinois, and you want to essentially extricate yourself from the former company and take your money. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
Okay. Now, here's the rule. The first rule is never, ever, 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 ever have the money sent to you. Don't have a check written to you. The reason is that the minute you do that, the employer is required to withhold 20% of whatever your vested balance is and whistle that right to the government, right? And then all of the money that you receive in that profit-sharing plan is subject to tax, income tax. And the government is hedging its bets. They want 20% of your money off the top because they're afraid that you're going to go out and spend it all and you're not going to have the money to pay the income tax. So the worst choice is essentially send me my money. I'm going to go spend it. A far better choice, and this is one of the choices that you have when you leave. In fact, I can even see the form from Benefit Planning Consultants. I almost know it by heart. That's one choice. Send me your money. That's a bad choice because they'll withhold the 20% and all of the money is subject to income tax. A second choice is if you have an excess, I believe, of $3,500 in the plan, you can leave it in the plan and continue to allow it to grow there, but you don't feel comfortable with that. So the third choice, excuse me, is to set up your own self-directed IRA program. You can do this at a bank. You can do this at a mutual fund company, an insurance company, a stock brokerage firm, and essentially provide directions to essentially have your profit-sharing monies liquidated where they are currently and sent trustee to trustee to your new IRA provider. This is a tax-deferred exchange. There is no tax on this exchange. And now you will have all of your funds in something called a self-directed IRA program. It's very, very popular. It's done thousands of times a day. It's convenient. It's easy. It's basically painless. And it sounds to me, in your situation, probably the best answer, because these are retirement monies and you really should save them for retirement. So my best advice would be, do you have a financial advisor or a planner or someone that you work with?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
Okay. So you should talk to them about this and rolling these funds over into a self-directed IRA. When they become self-directed, you can either direct them yourself and make the choices yourself. You could have your broker or financial planner help you make those choices. But whatever, you really want to effectuate a trustee-to-trustee or tax-deferred rollover. It's really what you want to do. You do not want to have that check payable to you, because it's instant problems and instant issues.
Because not only will they take the 20%, but then whatever I would have would also be subject to tax beyond that 20%.
Exactly. Let's look at it this way. Let's say that you have $10,000 in the plan, and you say, send me your money. Send me a check. First thing that happens is that the employer is going to send $2,000 to the government. That's 20%. Okay. And the entire $10,000, even though you only have $8,000 in your hands, the entire $10,000 will be added on to your income and will be taxed at your highest marginal rates. So that's a horrible, horrible result. You don't want to have that happen. Now that you're at the University of Illinois, you have the ability to participate in the University of Illinois 403B plan, where you can take money out of your paycheck. It's sort of like a 401k, and defer your own money into another retirement vehicle. And also, while you're at the U of I, you will then have the opportunity to participate in the University of Illinois retirement program, such as SERS, the State University Retirement System. So you really should sit down with the benefits people at the University of Illinois so you become fully cognizant of the different programs that are available, and there are many through the University of Illinois. There are cafeteria plans. There are 403B plans. There are pension plans, and it's important to sort of understand the nature of each and their differences. Okay.
Thanks.
Pleasure talking with you.
Let's continue. And I believe our next caller is Urbana and line two. Hello. Their caller there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I've been wondering about a little about the statistics that are being published for the economy these days. I know the most recent jobs report claimed that there were 288,000 jobs created in April. And I've been reading up on that, and I found out that the Bureau of Labor Statistics includes this this mathematical model called a birth-death model in adjusting the numbers. And the births and deaths refer to births and deaths of company, not people. It's where companies, you know, are formed, or at some times and go bankrupt or go out of business at other times.
Yes.
And the support my. What I've read is that it's supposed to be a seasonal adjustment, and that the adjustment for last month in April was actually 270,000 jobs was the contribution of that model for April, which means out of and that only 18,000 of those 288,000 jobs were actually real reported hirings. And so virtually all of the reported jobs created last year were just basically, you know, concocted by this mathematical model.
Well, you know, there's a lot of controversy over all of these models. And for many years, people have actually argued that they understate what's really going on in the economy because of the tremendous numbers of positions and jobs that are created in smaller businesses, which the DOL sort of conveniently forgets about. So I'm not disagreeing with you. It's a model is a model, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
So we're always at the beck and call of these different models. But clearly, a lot of people, as I say, have been arguing just the opposite, that there are many more jobs that are being created that are not being considered inside these models. But your point is well taken. It's a model, so it's not where we're pointing to. Yes, we can count up 288,000 positions.
So companies don't just regularly report to the government whenever they hire somebody?
Well, interestingly enough, companies receive from the government through the DOL a rather voluminous reporting system. Because I remember in private industry that I used to fill this out for myself, and once a month, I would meticulously fill this out of how many employees we had, how many male employees, how many female employees. But it is basically a voluntary system. They tell you it's not voluntary, that you're supposed to do this, but it is basically a voluntary system. So the minute we have a voluntary system, we're going to have error, aren't we? Mm-hmm. And indeed, they can't cover everyone, so it's a bit of a problem. So again, we have to keep in mind that these are estimates based upon econometric models.
Okay. Oh, well, I'll get off then. But just one last thing. It's just I see looking over, you know, the jobs created last month. Looking over the last 12 months, I know there was over 300 jobs actually taken out in January because of the post-Christmas layoffs. But as I look over the last 12 months of that model, it's actually added about 800,000 jobs net over the last 12 months, which maybe they have a wider definition of a seasonal adjustment, you know, over several, you know, corresponding to several years. But my understanding of a seasonal adjustment was that you add a few jobs one month and you take a few jobs out another month to even things out or make the data more accurate. But the data for the last year of that model shows that it's actually adding an average of like 60 or 70,000 jobs per month on average.
And really,
me,
what
I'll tell you what, let me just finish up and I'll hang up and listen. The other thing is the unemployment statistics, which I've heard a lot of stories that, you know, that's defined very narrowly also, that it does not include discouraged workers.
Exactly.
And any number of other things, so that the actual, a lot of people claim the actual unemployment rate is more like 10% instead of 5 or 6. So anyway, I guess my main point is I'm just trying to figure out what the real statistics are and, you know, how I can believe the ones put out by the government. And anyway, I'll listen to what you have to say.
Okay. Well, I'm not in disagreement with you. What I'm saying is that we have to probably, maybe an economist or two could call in and shed a little bit of light, maybe a professor from the university, on these job reports. They're based upon models. I think 10% unemployment, no, that's way too high. But clearly, the unemployment number that is reported does not include discouraged workers. On the other hand, the unemployment numbers also don't take into consideration the vast numbers of folks who are working in smaller businesses. And so that is sort of an offset. But like anything, they're numbers, they're trends, and we have to take them for what they are as trends in the economy. But your points are well taken.
We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. David Sinnoh is our guest. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. Once a month he's on this program. It's always a Friday. We talk about investing, money management, financial planning, those kinds of issues. If you have some sort of nuts and bolts questions about yourself and where you put your money and how you achieve your personal financial goals, I know that Dave will do his best to help you out if you want to give us a call. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think we have a caller here on line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm interested maybe in investing in housing and such, but do you think that there is a housing bubble? Certainly it would appear in certain sections of the United States.
A lot of people are going to argue that, especially in some of the urban areas. Look at Boston, look at San Diego. We're talking about enormous prices, San Francisco. But again, what typically has happened with housing bubbles in these areas in the past, it's not that the housing prices have gone down. It's that they've sort of just stabilized. Maybe they've gone down a few percent,
mm-hmm.
but they've stabilized. And again, when you look at these enormous prices that are being procured for housing in, say, San Diego, San Francisco, especially the West Coast and even Boston, you're looking at a supply-demand situation where there is tremendous demand, but very little supply. Very little supply, especially in new construction stock. Very, very difficult. The Midwest, lots of land, lots of construction, lots of potential supply. So I'm a little less concerned about a housing bubble where you have a situation where you haven't really bid up these houses tremendously because you always have the ability to build more based upon land. So in the housing bubble, land is the big factor. It's not the bricks and mortar. Land appreciates so much more dramatically than the bricks and mortar. So that's where the housing bubbles are really of concern, where you've had tremendous run-ups in the price of land and buildings, but yet you still have a substantial ability to expand in that area because of supply. That's where I would be most concerned.
Okay. The other one is that I also have a CD for the federal insurance. There's no particular problem with that. I know there was a big bailout. I don't remember that year for the savings and loan that time. Remember that?
I remember.
It cost the government hundreds of thousands, no, billions of dollars to bail them out.
That's correct.
I understand that there's not enough money in that in terms of the federal insurance. It's, we're starting to see them now in terms of some of these foreclosures and such. But actually, the main question is I have a TIA in Kraft and have an opportunity to put in, they have what equivalent to what commercial plant, for rentals and such, whether that would be a good idea to put some money into that or not.
TIA, Kraft, I'm not familiar with the program that you're referring to. What program is it exactly?
It's commercial real estate.
It's
sold the same way as stocks, that you get a certain percentage.
Okay. So you're thinking of doing that at the current time?
Right.
Is it, and I'm sorry that I'm not familiar with that exact vehicle. Is it a REIT index? Is it a real estate investment trust?
Yeah.
Where you're buying shares in a real estate investment trust?
Right.
Well, TIA Kref, number one, has had a tremendous run of success. They are an extremely well-run organization, and they're basically a pretty conservative organization, and they have always believed in the theory of indexing their investments.
Mm-hmm.
So a small percentage, I have a small percentage of my portfolio in REITs. So to the extent that you want exposure in real estate, if you feel that you are underexposed, then that certainly is one means of having liquidity in a real estate position and still participating. What REITs are going to do over the next 12, 18, 24 months are going to be directly impacted by interest rates and inflation. So it's unlikely they're going to have the kinds of run-ups that they have had in the last couple of years. But having said that, it still is an asset class that everyone should be represented in. So I don't have a problem with you having some exposure in that asset class.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe 10%.
Yeah, max 10%.
Okay. All right.
And as far as the FDIC, what the FDIC, remember, it's a quasi-governmental organization. They're going to pay. If a bank goes under, you can bet that those depositors up to $100,000 are going to be paid. And furthermore, all the FDIC does is turns around and then essentially taxes, if you will, all of the member banks to rebuild up the reserves. That's what happens.
Because I know they sell their paper, too, which is another issue.
Mm-hmm.
The investors are going to get stung on that. But anyway, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Next caller, East Moline, line 4. Hello.
Yes. If you had a person that's, say, going to retire at 50 years old, are there any conditions as far as just wanting to make a normal use of either 401k or IRA money under which a person can avoid that 10% tax penalty?
Not until you're 55. At age 55, the law says that you can take periodic payments, substantially equal periodic payments over your life expectancy, and then you avoid the 10% penalty, but not at age 50, unless you are disabled, et cetera. Otherwise, you're going to have that 10% penalty until age 55.
And that's in the case of either the 401k or the IRA?
Absolutely, assuming that you have a traditional IRA. It's not a Roth IRA.
Right. And what are the circumstances on a Roth? I've been retired for several years and have still been kicking into a Roth. Does that money have to be in there a certain length of time, regardless of your age, before you could tap it?
Well, typically, you can tap it after age 59 and a half. It does have the 59 and a half rule. But again, remember, when you pull money out of a Roth, if you're pulling the earnings out of a Roth, the earnings are not taxable, so you'd be paying the 10% penalty. So it's not nearly as egregious as pulling money out of a traditional IRA product. But if you are retired, remember to participate in a Roth and to contribute as you say you are doing. You must have earned income. So
or
I presume that you have some type of earned income.
Or a spouse doing so.
Exactly. Exactly. Then you can both participate as long as the spouse has it. And you can also, if you're over 50, do catch up. So you can put another $500
right.
in, for example.
Now, with regard to that person that wanted to retire, let's bump it up to, say, 55.
Yes.
And you're saying that they can take it out according to some lifetime plan for withdrawing it.
That's
are you
correct.
Then, once you take a payment, are you then obligated to continue taking them indefinitely?
Well, interestingly enough, then you can sort of transfer and change that at age 59 and a half. How about that?
Okay,
so there are ways around it, but you have to sit down with your accountant and work out the amortization schedule so you don't make any mistakes.
So in other words, then you would be obligated for at least 4.5 years, and then you might be able to adjust it after
that. You bet.
That.
You bet.
All right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
All right. Back here to Champaign for our next caller, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. I have a question about I'm having an issue with the financial consultant that I have.
Yes.
I have an inheritance. And I have a financial consultant that I've been working with who's invested that money for me.
Yes.
And last year, he called me up and talked to me about a new annuity and asked me if I wanted to put my money into that annuity. And he went through extensive explanations, and I decided to go ahead and do it. But then the problem with it is that now I have had to pay a lot of money in taxes. It's like tens of thousands of dollars in taxes because I did that. And I wouldn't have switched my money into this other annuity if I had known that I was going to have to pay all these taxes. And I'm just trying to find out if there's anything, if there's anything I can do to get that money back. Because I feel like I got bad advice.
Now, let me understand something. You inherited money, you placed it in an annuity,
uh-huh.
and then you cashed in that annuity and moved your money to a different annuity.
Right. And see, the problem was that it's my understanding that if they had moved the entire annuity to another annuity, if they'd done a rollover, then I wouldn't have had to pay any tax.
Well, that's correct. That was my next question. Why in the world did you not do what's called a 1035 exchange and do an annuity-to-annuity transfer, and then you would have been fine. You might have been subject to a penalty for leaving annuity number one. In other words, that insurance company might have been unhappy with you, and there might have been a penalty. But clearly, if they did not explain the tax consequences, I would raise a lot of concern with them and tell them that, in my opinion, that you need to make this right.
Okay.
All right?
Is this something that an attorney could or should help me out with?
Well, I think clearly that the first thing that you should do is go back to your company and say, this happened to me. You did not explain this to me. You need to take care of this in the next 30 days.
Okay.
So you give them a timetable, all right, to
okay.
solve your problem. At that point in time, I would suggest after that, you probably, if you do not get satisfaction, and if the facts are as you have explained them to me, then you would need to probably procure some type of advice, either from an accounting firm or from a law firm, as to how best to proceed.
Okay. Because I actually got a fax from them saying that they intentionally did not do a like-kind exchange, the 1035 exchange.
Well, I don't know the circumstances and all of the facts, but I'm saying that it's highly unusual that you would first of all move from one annuity to another, and then it's extraordinarily unusual that it would be done with a taxable event.
Okay.
So I think you need to jump on this and give them a deadline to solve your problem.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for your help.
All right. Thank you. We'll go here again to another Champaign caller. This would be line 2. Hello.
Hi. Couple of questions. We're expecting our first child this year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Just there's so much just to plan for that, but then also financially. What are some of the first things I should consider as far as setting up for, I mean, is it like a savings plan? Do I start thinking of that? Do I start thinking about tax implications, all that kind of stuff?
Are you in a position to save for this child?
Well, there's some one of the other things going on, that was the second part of the question, is my husband is starting his own business. So we're trying to figure out how to plan for, you know, to have his retirement, you know, supplemented as well. So.
And are you going to be a stay-at-home mom, which is just like working 36 hours a day?
Or? Oh, no, I'll keep working.
Okay, so you're going to keep working at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And are you and at your place of work, are you contributing to 401k plans or profit-sharing plans or things like that?
Right.
And you're intending to continue to do that, I presume.
Yes, that's not going to change.
Okay, so number one, don't you change what you are doing in terms of your retirement.
Okay.
Okay. Number two, starting your own business is expensive.
Right.
I hope it's well thought out, and I wish a lot of luck.
Yeah.
But it's going to take some time.
Right.
It's going to take some time. You know, even a business that ultimately becomes profitable usually takes a minimum of 3 years to become profitable.
Yeah.
All right?
We're finding that out.
You're finding that out. And the major reason that businesses fail are because they haven't been well thought out.
Yeah.
All right? And they are not capitalized at a level that really makes sense because you need that 3-year staying power.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of saving for a child at this point in time, I think probably the best thing to do is if you are in a position on a monthly basis to place money perhaps in a simple index mutual fund.
Okay.
All right. Not in the child's name.
Oh.
Not in a college education savings plan at the moment.
Okay.
All right. I'd rather have you do this perhaps even in your name. And perhaps taking a certain amount of money on a monthly basis and buying even something as simple as an S&P 500 fund.
Okay. And that would be, because right now I have a certain amount of money that goes into a savings account, kind of like my own personal one, that is going into I think it's just a money market account. And I've been thinking of switching that into something different because, you know, it's just sitting there and not doing much of anything, but then transferring that over for the baby.
I'm just a little concerned that until the baby is born, and you can wait until the baby is a year old or something, because of all of these other things that are going on in your life, to tie up large sums of money in a college education savings plan at the moment where you might have difficulty accessing it or not wanting to access it. That's not to say that I'm not in favor of immediately saving for the child. I just want to be real careful here that you have the liquidity that you need to make sure that you can deal with all of these other needs.
Okay.
All right.
Now, as far as retirement for my husband,
what types of programs would he be eligible for?
Right.
Well, there's all kinds of things, of course. In addition to Roth IRA programs that you're both eligible for, and you probably know about Roth IRAs,
right?
There is something called a self-employment IRA, a SEP IRA.
Oh,
it's very, very popular among small businesses where you could really take at least 15% of your compensation and put it aside in your own retirement plan.
And there's no limits for that?
Well, there's 15% versus, I believe it's now up to $40,000, whichever is less. What a wonderful problem to have that you could put $40,000
right.
aside. Let's only hope that that would occur.
Yeah.
But remember, in a SEP IRA, whatever you do for yourself, you would also have to do for your employees. Is your husband going to have employees?
Not immediately.
It's
kind of a self.
Okay, so it's sort of a consulting type of thing. Almost.
Yeah, and
okay.
So then he'll.
So those work out very, very well for SEP IRAs, so you could look into that as well.
Okay. So that would be good for him.
Wonderful.
Then just wait about a year or so before really planning for.
I really think so. I think you want to see how this all comes down before you tie up enormous amounts of capital in any one place and stay fairly liquid.
Okay.
Stay liquid.
Okay.
You bet.
And that's actually what we've been, without much thought to it, we just said, we've got this much and let's make sure we keep that in there. And that's just in the regular, interest-bearing checking account.
Right.
It's got at least the 3 months. Salary kind of thing going in there.
Now, is this business going to be a consulting business?
It's more of a services business.
Okay.
So, it's just him.
Okay.
And
is there any major liability issues with this particular business?
Well, he's going to be looking into getting bonded.
Okay. All right.
Because he does go into people's homes.
All right. So that's very important. You must have a bond, because one of the issues, you don't want to be sued and not have the appropriate insurance.
Right. Now, as far as the other thing that he's talked to people, I guess at SCORE, I think it's called SCORE. It's a small business. They're like retired business people.
Right.
I think they told him the easiest thing to get started is he just does it under his own name.
Well, that's right. That's a sole proprietorship.
Right.
Use your Social Security number. It's clean, neat, simple, but make certain that you get some liability insurance.
Right. So then they said he could look for a limited...
An LLC. Once he becomes essentially productive in this business, it's an ongoing business, then you probably would want to change your form of business to a limited liability company.
Uh-huh.
That's called an LLC.
Well, that's what he's wondering. Is there a certain threshold where that occurs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is usually that threshold?
Well, that would be where you know you're going to stick in this business and you're making money in the business and et cetera. So that's really the threshold.
Okay.
And that's not a tremendously expensive business to set that up, especially for yourself.
And does that require attorney help?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So definitely get into that. Mm-hmm. But then, the bonded part he wanted to get taken care of.
Got to do that right away.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you. Well, I think we're at the point where we're going to have to finish. My apologies. We have a caller we can't take, but we pretty much used up our time for now. We'll say thanks to our guest, David Sinnoh.
What a pleasure.
Much.
Lots of interesting questions, David.
He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I College of Business. He's on the program once a month. It's always a Friday, and we try to answer these questions. So stay tuned. He'll be back again next month. The program here, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the afternoon magazine, to bring to justice perpetrators of genocide, investigators must find proof that the victims were non-combatants. This is the work of forensic anthropologists. They work to learn the identities of the victims and how they were killed. On the afternoon magazine today, the host, Celeste Quinn, will be talking about the work, this kind of work, with Clea Koff. She was selected to go to Rwanda in 1996. She has also investigated graves in Bosnia and Kosovo. She's the author of the book The Bone Woman, A Forensic Anthropologist's Search for Truth in the Mass Graves of Rwanda, Bosnia, Croatia, and Kosovo. And you can hear that during the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine today. Celeste Quinn is the host. Also, 12:35, Mike Sola will have the weekend weather forecast, and then you can talk to Mike if you have plans for traveling this weekend or early next week. You can call in and he will give you a forecast for your destination. It's all part of the afternoon magazine coming up at noon today here on AM 580. The host, Celeste Quinn. We'll have more Focus. We'll have some news first, though, an update on the markets.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art. Located in the southeast lot of Lincoln Square Mall, downtown Urbana.